that it's looking at. In other words, what it sees. So, I want to have a discussion about that, but I can't right now because I got to run. But for next time, I think it's something that would be interesting to talk about.
Well, I agree with you. And that's an area not very well understood for people who haven't worked in the industry and done a tangential sensitivity test, which uses the square law characteristic most of the time, or when you build a video-type log-IF amplifier, which again uses the square law characteristic of diode detectors at low-level signal. It's also interesting that a diode rectifier for weak signals with bias, DC bias on the diode in order to increase its sensitivity, will have a square law characteristic up to approximately minus 20 dBm. And for stronger signals than that, it starts sliding into linear, and that's all explainable. So we'll go into that a little bit next week, Andy, when you've got some more time. Good subject. Okay, Mel, so have any of your guys put up any decorations on their towers? I would guess the guys in Brooklyn are a little bit more low-key and a little bit more quiet about their towers. Don't quite advertise like that. Some of the guys in Suffolk County are proud of their towers, with Christmas tree lights on them. And I bet you've received some nice mail this week. K2KDY, K2LIW.
RGW with a little question.
RGW, we'll get to you in a second. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, very good. This is K2KDY. All right, then you are a very interesting subject. And, okay, we'll leave that for next week. That can take up a bit of time. And before I get into basically what we usually start to discuss, that come in. We'll continue with DD. We started on decibels last week. I see a number of emails here. Please continue with that simple explanation. They underline the word simple. Keep the math at a minimum. So I promise to do that and stay away from that that terrible L word. Let me think. As far as powers go, no. I don't think I should bring attention to a colliding number. That would be the last thing I would think of doing. thank God so far, no flack from it. I'm late. So I'll just leave it that way. I'll say no more. Pick up the other station personnel and get started. Over.
Okay. Mr. RGW, give us your full call and your name, and then proceed with your loop question. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
K2 RGW. Chris, I checked in earlier with no traffic, and you guys shook some out of me. I have a 135-foot doublet out of wire that was a homemade open wire line, 4 3/4 inch on center. It's all 14 gauge, and it's not in the air yet, and feeding it, getting the ladder line out to where it needs to be for the reach of the doublet is tricky. So I'm considering adding another 135 feet and turning it into a loop to make it more convenient. And the way I have to support it is the house would be the base corner of an isosceles triangle, a tree, and the distance would be the far corner of the base of an isosceles triangle, and the peak of the isosceles triangle would be a tree further out away from the structure. And my question is, how much of an atrocity for the performance of that loop would it be to have it fed with the open wire line at a somewhat random placement along the long side of an isosceles triangle? And I would be feeding it with a Palstar roller inductor tuner.
Yeah, you really got sort of two questions there. Are you going to be better off with the loop antenna as opposed to a half-wave dipole, or a doublet, as you called it? And also your methods of feeding it. And, Mel, you probably had half-wave dipoles as well as your full-wave loop. I know they both behave differently. And then for the comparison, it's going to be a little bit apple and oranges. But still, I'll bet you've got an overall feeling for which one gives you more tinkering, which one gives you more capability when you got the right kind of an antenna tuner, and which one gives you the biggest bang for the dollar. If you were starting off fresh right now with your current experience with both kinds of antennas, would you first put up a full-wave loop, or would you first put up a half-wave dipole? That's what I think is one of the hidden questions here, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW on the TechNet.
quick clarification. The primary use would be for regional, for 80, and to cross the two connections, feed it as a single line for 160 for regional use, DX, and the height is not there. I don't have the ability to get up high enough, and DX is much of a concern.
Okay. More variables added to the mix then. You've got it, Mel.
Hi, Jeff. I'm just going to basically say the same thing. This is K2KEY. I did not put up the loop for DX. I do low band DXing on 80 meters, but I use a vertical. I have a vertical of 66 feet tall that has 100 radials under it that I use for the low end of 80 meters for working low band DXing. The loop antenna was primarily, as you said, for regional. I talked to my friend in Pennsylvania. Couple of friends there. I have a friend in Massachusetts that joins us regularly, and Virginia, another station. And so I looked for an antenna that would give me that kind of good coverage. And originally I had dipoles. In fact, my dipole was up quite high. It was up a good 65, 70 feet up. The original 80 meter dipole, 75, 80 meter dipole. And I found that with the loop, at least talking to these people that I just mentioned, I found that I do much, much better with the loop. As you say, not interested in DX, so ideally the loop seems to fit the bill for this kind of amateur radio. As far as 160 goes, I was going to mention about 160. What I do on 160 is one end of the loop, as it comes in the open wire feeder, goes to ground, goes to a very hefty ground system. And the tuner also joins it. The one side of my tuner has also a grounding bar that's actually this part of Johnson Kilowatt Matchbox. They actually show you how to match different systems, and they can provide you with a grounding bar on there, so that casing and the one end of the loop then is grounded, and it is then fed to the one terminal on the tuner with the other one grounded and one side of the loop grounded. And it works quite well. I have not done a lot, I won't say, on 160, just I have gotten on 160, just to get a feel of it. I got to say, most of my operating with the loop is on 75 meters with my friends in the evening. Also, I've used the loop as it is with the same regular balance input system as I do feed it on 80 meters. I've also used it on 40 meters. Works basically almost about the same on 40 meters. I say very little different. I found, however, I have a second antenna that I use. I mentioned I put up a vertical dipole for 40 meters, and I found it worked real well. In fact, last night I go perfectly in the situation with pileups, and last night was a real beauty of a pileup because a new DX entity came in on 40 meters. If anybody out there is interested in hitting it, new DX country, Foxtrot Juliet FJ has come on from St. Monterey Island. With the OH2BH Marty Lane group down there. So they'll be operating mostly CW. So if you're interested, look either on the low end of 40-meter CW band around 7010 or up around 7042 or so. They're operating either or of that part of the band. But to work them, I should say, I definitely had to use, of course, the vertical dipole, whereas the loop, again, is like you said, a regional antenna. So you almost got to really have two antennas if you're going to do any kind of simultaneous operating on these particular bands. Go ahead, Jeff.
Go right ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, it's just listening to this. I've been doing a bit of antenna modeling and experimenting with a few antennas over the last 6 months. I think you might have heard some of my feedback on it. But one of the antennas, I don't know, it's just something that I discovered that was the worst performer, which I didn't think was what my data was showing, the worst performing antenna that I had on the amateur band was horizontally polarized dipole. And comparing that to vertical antennas and other things, in operating with the antenna, what I discovered with different antennas is that for most of the amateur bands, at least in the low band, a vertically polarized antenna is going to get you a lot of performance because there's a lot of signals out there in vertical polarization and a lot of stations you can reach. The antennas that are generally on or the stations that are have all of the horizontally polarized signals are the big dogs with the monster beams up at 7 feet. And when you try to compete in pileup against people with antennas on very, very high antenna towers and the horizontal polarization with a lot of gain with your dipole, you're going to be in the swell zone. You're going to be way down at the bottom. But if you have your antenna vertically polarized, generally it seems that there's more stations that are going to come back to you, and you're a little bit more even, so to speak. So that was just something that I had noticed, and I've gotten away completely from any kind of a horizontal dipole system in it.
Disagree, WJ2B.
Go right ahead, Joe. What's your experience?
Definitely, I have quite a bit of experience on 80 meters, and I have seen just exactly the opposite of that. The people with the verticals on 80 meters, with the better antenna for DX, but for local communication, within 300 to 400 miles, the people with the horizontal dipoles, horizontal antennas that are running, you know, and probably pretty close to the ground, so they're using them for NVIS operation. Those are the people that have the best signals on 80 meters by far. Anybody that comes on a vertical that's in the short distance range on 80 meters usually is a very small signal compared to the horizontal guys. So that could be the WJ2B.
From what I'm hearing,
since
a well-constructed pure vertical half-wave dipole, you've got a tall enough support to do it, and a full half-wave vertical dipole doesn't require a counterpoise. And vertical has got certain advantages, horizontal has got certain advantages. Either antenna is very expensive. I would put up both and have a switch where I could flip back and forth between the two, both on transmit and receive. Each has its advantages at certain times. So when in doubt as to antenna A or antenna B, consider the possibility of putting up both A and B at the same time. These are some of the opinions we're slowly coming to here, Chris. KT2RGW, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Another comment to BJ.
Yeah, thank you very much for the comments and the information. I have a gap-type vertical that is ground-mounted, and the last station I just called is exactly my experience. It is top-loaded on 80, and I'll come in at about an S1 to an S3 with 100 watts to that antenna for regional. And I strung a random wire about 7 feet high and fed it for my tuner, threw it over a tree, tied it to a fence, no measurements, and I was instantly an S8 with that wire on 80. So that's part of why I'm getting to this. I wanted to try to stick to 100 watts as long as I can. That'd have to run a lot of power, and that's why I'm looking for a boost. So that's why I'm considering the loop. Sounds like the loop, and then being able to switch back and forth between my vertical and that loop. Do just the trick. And just real briefly, I just want to thank you and all the people who participate in this net. I haven't been able to check in, but I've been monitoring for a long, long time in a handheld. And the information here is just invaluable. I'm a new ham as of April, and it really shakes the cobwebs out of my electronics theory listening here. And it's just an invaluable service. Thank you. KC2RGW, back to the group.
KC2QXU with one more comment.
Okay, we've got both Joe and Glenn in that order. Also, I want to tell you, Chris, that you can listen to the past TechNet, believe it or not. They're all recorded by an extremely enthusiastic guy named Mike Perry, KC2NJI, November Juliet, India. He goes back now to September of 2006, and every one of them recorded and documented. If you go to www.amateurradio.television, amateurradio.tv, Tango Victor, amateurradio.tangovictor, and you will then find all the past TechNet. I've been told that some of the technical schools in New Jersey are, the professors are suggesting that their electrical engineering students listen to some of that material to learn background information. The people who are ham radio operators are the hands-on people who really know wireless, and the schools are having a devil of a job trying to really teach wireless engineering, radio engineering. When we get a chance, then, Mel, one of the earlier questions that Chris asked that we didn't yet approach is there any advantage in him having more than one feed point where he can feed the bottom of the loop, the side of the loop, the top of the loop, and or have wires coming down with a switch where he can close or open? I'm not sure you've actually done that experiment, although you talk to so many loop people, I'll bet you some of the loop users have done things like that. So in a couple of minutes, we're going to turn it over to you, Mel, to see if you've got some comments on that. In the meantime, we've got Joe and Glenn with some further comments. Joe first, WJ2B, you got it, Joe.
Hey there, just wanted to put my two cents in from my experience again with different characteristics of antennas there. I just wanted to say that when you're talking ground wave, let's say from a base to a mobile, let's say on 10 meters, and you know, within, let's say, 20 or 30 miles of distance, where the mobile antenna is seeing the base station antenna with direct line of sight or direct ground wave type propagation, not involving the ionosphere, that's where you want to have like polarization. So if the mobile is vertical, you want your base station to be vertical. If the base is horizontal, mobile is vertical, you have a tremendous amount of, I guess, around 20 dBs of cross polarization loss. When you're talking about base station to base station and the ionosphere is acting as you know, a reflector, from what everybody was saying before, which is obviously the case, is you can get rotation of the signal. So polarity is less important and radiation or takeoff angle is much more important for your base type antenna. A vertical will give you a much lower angle of radiation, as will a very high up, you know, a dipole that's at least half wavelength above the ground. That will give you low angle radiation, which is good for long distance, DX, you know, 1,000 miles or greater. And a low horizontal dipole, less than a quarter wavelength high, which would be in the NVIS mode, will have very high angle radiation. Basically, the RF is going straight up, and that gives you much better close-in signal strength, you know, to people within the, let's say, two, you know, anywhere from 40 to 200 miles away from you to get the best, you know, signal out the, you know, the local area. So you want a, you know, cloud warmer for local. You want low angle vertical or a very high dipole for long distance DX. There's more my two cents. If I go to you, the WJ2B.
Each kind of antenna has its advantage. They're not super expensive. So I think if we've got the real estate, we should all consider eventually putting up both. Glenn, KC2QIQ, go right ahead with your comment.
Sure. I think there was something I was a little confused. Maybe I didn't describe it well enough. What I was basically saying was that the polarization of the signal is not necessarily the physical dimension of the antenna being vertical or horizontal. A lot of the experiments I've been doing over the last 6 months was looking at what signals are coming in, and who am I speaking to, and what are the polarizations of their antennas. I was asking many amateurs about the polarization of the signals, because I would measure from both on the observer's seat signal with both the vertical and the horizontal position. And I would ask the question, are you vertically or horizontally polarized? And I was getting a very strong signal in the vertical polarization. And they would say, oh, my antenna is horizontally polarized. And then I would ask them a little bit more, you know, a few more questions maybe about how their antenna was constructed. So I'd find out it would either be some kind of either a quad or a loop that was mounted very, very close to the ground. And my experience so far that I've seen is that warm wire antenna loops that are mounted very close to the ground tend to have a vertical signal polarization. So that's what I was finding, the vertical polarization of the signal, not necessarily that the way that the antenna is laid out or physically may look horizontal, but the signal actually is, with respect to the ground, vertically polarized. And I also noticed in, you know, feed points and feeding loops, the best location I've found for feeding the loop is the location is where you can actually get the best match to your feed line. Back over to you, Ben.
Yeah. You formed an opinion with reference to square loop antennas close to the ground. I'm of the opinion that even if the man knows that he's launching purely horizontal, purely vertical, or purely slant 45 degrees to the right polarization, once the signal has been through the ionosphere, depending on the day, where the terminator line is, what the state of the ionosphere, what frequency you're on, is it night or day or whatever, you get different amounts of Faraday rotation. We've all experienced a lot of fading of the signal we're listening to. And a lot of time that fade is not because the signal is skipping over your house, it's because it's cross-polarized to your particular antenna. And if you have both a horizontal and vertical or any other polarization antenna on the property, and you flip from one to the other while you're receiving, sometimes a null on one antenna will not be a null on the other because of its Faraday rotation. As I've been saying, it is a phenomenon that is not being mentioned a whole lot, and I think it's a little bit silly because it's with us all the time. Very few guys put up more than one antenna in order to accommodate what Mother Nature is doing with the ionospheric polarization. I mean, we have all kinds of motivations for putting up horizontal, vertical, high, low, loop, dipole, triangle, square, whatever antennas. We put up all kinds of different antennas, usually because we either want short-range or long-range QSOs. But to correct the polarization phenomenon and to study that further is another motivation for putting up multiple antennas. Mel, I wonder if you've heard of guys who have experimenting with feeding the near end of the loop, the far end of the loop, flipping back and forth with relays, opening or shorting the far end, as well as raising and lowering visual portions of their full wave loop. I bet you've heard of all of these experiments, and I wonder if anyone has come up with techniques that they think are worth all the extra effort. K2KEY, K2RIW on the TechNet.
This is K2KEY. The best example I could give you is the diamond loop. I was privy to see a demonstration that was quite impressive, but the duplicated would be kind of difficult because it was done under very good conditions with a lot of real estate. I mean, a tremendous amount of real estate where they actually did have the control with four towers involved and electric winches to tilt the thing, and it was quite a large undertaking. But it proved the theory of the loop, basically. In the past, I have talked to quite a number of people about feeding it, and it seems like almost all of them have said the square loop seems to still be a situation where you can feed it any which way, any place. A number of them have set it right at one of the corners, like say a foot in from one of the corners. A number have set it in the middle of between two supports, 65-foot supports. That's basically what I'm doing, and it doesn't seem to make a difference. Of course, like I said, I did feed it two different ways. I originally had one feed, the open feeder, going across to the other side of the loop. In other words, I was feeding it directly opposite. If you look at a square, and I actually be feeding it either, in this case, my situation, the north side and the south side. So I had that running, of course, into that, I could say, that night switch combination, and doing all kinds of combinations. But getting back to why I put up the loop and what is necessity, I found again, eventually all I did is simplify the whole thing. Better than the one side, the south side, which is where my shack is located on the south side of the house. Dropped it down, the feed line, the open wire feed line, I could say, down, and then come back up into the shack, and I left it at that because I wasn't really looking to, accomplish more with the loop than it seems to do very well right now. Even though there have been experiments that have showed very unusual patterns when you start doing some of these configurations, like mechanically tilting the situation, making it more or less now from a quad, that's a horizontal quad, bringing it more towards the vertical situation, I think. But that's a whole different situation from what I was looking into or
of stuff. As you can tell, antennas are our greatest area of experimentation. I've often said that built inside of each serious amateur radio operator is the scientist who wants to get out. In the old days, back in when Mel and I first cut our teeth with ham radio, a significant percentage of guys would build their own transmitter and build their own receiver. My first rig was a homebrew. A heat kit for the receiver and a transmitter that was purely homebrew. Nobody nowadays with single sideband and 52 functions inside of a rig builds their own transmitter, with rare exception. 0.01% of the hands build their own transmitter or build their own receiver for HF frequencies. As you get up to the higher UHF and microwave frequencies, a larger percentage of people build because they have no choice. They want certain powers and frequencies and whatever, and a piece of equipment doesn't exist, and they build it. But on HF, we are appliance operators for the most part when it comes to the transmitter and the receiver. Some of us will build our own matchbox in modern times, as Mel did, just to make sure he has the ability to fully switch in an analog manner between the differential mode and the common mode of feeding his open wire line to his loop antenna. But the antenna itself and the methods of feeding it is one of the places where it's not expensive. We can have a lot of fun fiddling, experimenting, testing, trying better techniques, talking to people, comparing notes, and so on. It's part of the fun part if you want to be a researcher, a person. So do consider putting up more antennas than you thought you need. A horizontal, a vertical, a loop, a square, a yagi, a diamond, and so on. Each has its advantages. For the most part, they're not expensive, and a lot of fun to experiment with them. One other thing I should mention on an entirely different subject is that ham radio-wise, we have lost two giants this week. The one we all know about from LiveOnk is Norm K2YEW. He used to be called Young, Eager, and Willing. And he's a former president of the LiveOnk Club, as well as a man on the board of directors for many, many years. Also, he was on the committee for people at Huntington High School who would teach ham radio classes. There are hundreds of hams out there who got their license by way of the Morse code and theory classes that Mel has, that Norm has issued. He also is a member of DART, D-A-R-T, a group of people that call themselves Defense Amateur Radio Towers. And on at least 13 or 14 occasions that I know about, he gave testimony before a zoning board defending an amateur radio tower application before a zoning board. So a very active amateur, Norm, and he's going to be missed. He passed away suddenly from a coronary while driving, while on 450 megacycles. You could say he passed away with the microphone in his hand while driving. So he was doing what he enjoyed most at the time. Another giant that passed away was Stanfield, W2OQI, Obo, Quebec, India, who lived in Santa Maria, and a man heavily involved with the Coast Guard, with the Park Amateur Radio Club, which is the, why am I having trouble thinking of what Park stands for, Peconic Amateur Radio Club, a member of that, running repeaters out there in eastern Suffolk, an extremely active amateur. The people in eastern Suffolk consider him the best Elmer they've ever had, and he passed away this week too. So as I said, we've lost two giants. I believe Dan's funeral was yesterday, and Norm's was today. Anybody with any further comments on this particular subject before we go on, give us a call that is right now. K2RIW on the TechNet.
Yes, W2EWK. That's the reason why I get so depressed when sometimes when I turn my radio on, I hear someone passing away. And also I get very depressed when I go to church. I hear people passing away, you know, at church as well. So I guess I'm depressed all the time. W2EWK.
Yeah, we sort of have to do what we can to enjoy it while we're here, Eugene, to be using a wry sense of humor. You could say we're not going to get out of this one alive. We're all going to die someday. but be kind to each other and try to do some good in the meantime is the best we can do. Now, Mel, on a more pleasant note, I bet you've got some further discussions on decibels. I'm going to pass in a couple of words before I pass it over to you. My favorite way of using decibels is by pure memory. Yes, I've got a handheld calculator, and there are times when I calculate decibels to the nearest four decimal places because I'm doing something where I need that kind of accuracy. But whenever you change the power of a transmitter by a 2-to-1 ratio, you're going up or down 3 decibels. 2-to-1 in power, 3 decibels. 4-to-1 in power, 6 decibels. So if I'm running a 100-watt transmitter and I cut it back to 25 watts, I'm really going down 6 decibels in power, 4-to-1 ratio. And on a well-calibrated S meter, each 6 decibels is supposed to be 1 S unit. When you go from S9 to S8, if the machine was well-calibrated, not many of them are, that's a 6-decibel change, 4-to-1 in power or 2-to-1 in voltage. Simply because voltage squared over resistance equals power. Double the voltage, you're going up 4-to-1 in power, and you're going up 6 dB. So 3 dB is 2-to-1 in power, 6 dB is 4-to-1 in power, 10 dB is 10-to-1 in power. Those are the 3 most memorized power ratios. If I go from 10 watts output with a brick amplifier to 100 watts output with a brick amplifier, I've increased my power by 10-to-1, and in that particular case, it's also 10 decibels of increase, a little bit shy of 2S units on a well-calibrated S meter. You could go one step beyond that. 100-to-1 in power is 20 decibels. 10-to-1 voltage ratio is 101 in power, and that's 20 decibels. So if I was running a 1-watt transmitter, and I then start using a kilowatt transmitter, let me think now. That would be, I didn't do that right. 1 watt to 100 watts, that's the 100-to-1 ratio. 1 watt transmitter to 100-watt transmitter, that would be 20 decibels. 100-to-1 in power ratio, which is 10-to-1 in voltage ratio, is 20 decibels. Those are about as far as you've got to memorize. 100-to-1, 20 dB. 10-to-1, 10 dB. 4-to-1, 6 dB. 2-to-1, 3 dB. That's one of the easiest ways to use decibels, is to memorize those numbers, and there are ways of combining them. But we won't go into that one right now. That'll scare you a little bit. So you don't have to use that L word. You don't have to use the mathematics, even though almost every handheld calculator does have a so-called log scale to it, or a log key. Decibels are very handy because there are times when very big power ratios are easy to handle with decibels. 1 microvolt of signal out of a signal generator used to test the sensitivity of a, let's say, a 2-meter handy-dandy receiver. 1 microvolt is -107 dBm. dBm is decibels with reference to a milliwatt. So 107 decibels, weaker than 1 milliwatt, that's why it's -107 dBm. That happens to equal 1 microvolt. Every good receiver should get a pretty strong reception with a 1 microvolt signal. If not, it's time to bring it over to Andy, W-A-2-C-D-O, and ask them to fix it and find out what's wrong. Over to you, Mel, K2KEY, our instructor on both decibels and the Smith chart and loop antennas and Collins equipment and how to keep wives happy, K2RIW in the tech net. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay. One last Mel. I emailed Mel a picture of the amplifier that I built. Did you get that, Mel?
No. I don't think so, Rich. I'll take a look again. I don't think it's... No, I did not get it. I do not see it here. Rich. Very surprised. Maybe he'll send it again sometimes for some reason. I think the email sometimes is reliant as snail mail. So I did not get it. So when did you send it, Rich, over?
Oh, gee, a couple of weeks ago. I sent it to KKKY@AWRL.net.
That's right. That's the email. But surprised I did not see it. I surely didn't pass over it because I do look at them one by one. I check each one by one to see what the subject is. What did you use the subject as the linear amplifier, over?
Yeah, I sure did.
Okay, I'll tell you what, send it again. Whenever you get a chance, and I'll take a look tomorrow and see if maybe comes through this time, Rich, over.
Okay, very good, Mel. And then, you know, I want to revisit the subject you brought up earlier, failure in radios. I heard Yesu, Kedwood, ICOM mention. Nobody brought up Temtec. I got into Temtec maybe, what, 5, 6 years ago? And I can honestly say I don't know of any design problems with any of the Temtec radios. I started off with a Jupiter, went to an Omni 7, now I've got the Orion 2, and I'm quite happy with the American-made product. Temtec.
It's a good sign. I have heard some very positive words about Temtec, and so you're saying that you've heard nothing negative. Boy, that's a very good testimonial.
Okay. I just want to comment that, while we got a second here, tropospheric ducting down the coast is exceptionally good tonight. People might want to look for that, and it might be good tomorrow again. I guess it's all this warm weather. We're getting very good ducting in 2MB and Rockaway.
Are you hearing 432 and places like that down to Virginia and North Carolina?
Exactly. That's why I brought it up, yes. In spite of the fact that it's raining, usually you lose it when it starts to rain, but it's still coming in pretty good.
How about 2 meters and 12 minutes? Which bands have you listened down the coast, and how far have you heard?
Okay, I've been hearing down, it's coming and going, and I'm hearing down throughout Virginia tonight, and I'm hearing a 432 and 2 meters. I didn't check 1296. I will in a little while. But so far, 2 and 432 are looking very good. And I'm surprised nobody noticed that, you know, probably repeaters and things coming in. I didn't check them, but they should be.
On both 2 and 432, I'm guessing you're using horizontally polarized antennas. How many Yagis? How many feet up, Barry?
Okay, just one Yagi. I think it's 16 elements or something like that. And it's about 90 feet off the ground. And of course, I'm right on the ocean, so, you know, things could change as you move inland.
That was your 2-meter antenna you just described?
Yes, yeah. The 432 antenna is an RIW, and just one up on the tower right now.
You used to have 16, Barry.
Yeah, I know. We'll get back to that, don't worry.
Yeah, me too. I used to have 16, too, and I'm dreaming up about getting back to it. Why don't you add to your decibel lecture and the mailbag, your choice. K2KEY, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Yeah, fine business. And, you know, the mailbag has been very interesting, some of the comments. Mostly have a lot on it. The situation, as they said, they enjoyed the opening remarks about the DBs, how it originated, and just basically for those who missed it last week, we talked about the derivation of DB, which originally comes from the telephone company, Alexander Graham Bell, when he basically came up with the telephone system and was granted the patent on it. They began to, of course, run wire, and that's when, you know, things started showing up that they never anticipated in previous experiments when the, you know, it's just basically an experimental type of device. The basically what they were looking for, the telephone company at the time of the beginning, was a yardstick to make measurements with. Just like you use a yardstick if you were an automotive engineer, you look for maybe looking at the horsepower as your yardstick. If you were a banker, you would look at the dollar bill as your yardstick. If you're going out to buy an automobile, you look at miles per gallon as your yardstick. In other words, something to compare one thing to another. So what happened was with the phone company at the time, with the Bell, Alexander Graham Bell and his crew there doing the experiment, they came up with this yardstick that basically they ran a mile of wire. They experimented with different kinds of wire and found that number 19 copper was best for the situation. They also experimented with a frequency response, and they found between 300 and 3,000 cycles per second was the good frequency response. So they took that 1,000 as their standard. And they also now have to get one more situation. How loud does it have to be? And also, you know, with the situation is now when you start running wire and their losses come in, how do you fix these losses and how do you measure, you know, the improvement? So they started looking around for something to add to this yardstick known as the terminal unit, the Bell terminal unit. Factor was still basically into the 30s, I'm saying into the 40s, still considered their yardstick, the terminal unit. So what they did, they sat down one day and they used this tuning fork system to generate the 1,000 cycles, the second signal that they used as their input to their transmitter. The microphone that you talk into on the telephone was called the transmitter. The thing that gets your ear was called the receiver, so the transceiver was born. That's the beginning of the transceiver. And what they did, they found that they could take this tuning fork and create a signal going, coming out of it that was 10 times. They could make it keep increasing until they were sure that they increased it 10 times. And that became known as the Bell, And the problem, of course, was that it was very loud. And, you know, to evaluate improvements to things, you know, you had to be able to listen. And they would usually get a group of people together listening, you know, and somebody would talk at one end or use the tuning fork. And it was hard to get a concise opinion to this. You know, whatever they were tweaking on, they're putting capacitors and transformers on. Is it getting louder, the same? And some people said it was twice as loud. Some people say three times. Some people would say similar. You know, same thing. In other words, the human ear is not really, you know, a good criteria because we can only recognize, you know, a really profound difference. So they started looking around for something to measure with. And this is where we get into the next step. First of all, any questions? Okay, so what happened? They found that if 80% of the signal got through from the person or the signal coming off the tuning fork, if 80% of it went through the line, that it was a good communication. So one of the people that is mathematicians that work there, he says, I got an idea. He says, how to set up a standard. And he says, instead of 80%, let's say 79.4326% gets through. Okay, he twerks the 80% a little bit. And he says, well, what's the reason for that? He says, well, let's look at it this way. If 79.4% rounded out gets through, and we were to multiply it by itself three times, 79.4 times 79.4 times 79.4, guess what happens?
it comes out to 50%. And we can call that 50%, you know, of the signal. So, okay, that sounds good. And he says that if you take 79.4%, multiply it by itself 10 times, it comes out to 10. So they said, okay, we'll call this 1, 3 times, 3 units, and 10 times, 10 units. He says, no. He says, let's call it deci. We'll take the 10, we'll divide it up into 10. We'll call it deci, so that we don't have to say, you know, there are 3 units plus or 3 units minus. We'll just be asked to put a little sign in front of plus or minus. So, here it is. The dB was born. So instead of saying 3 units, we say 3 dB. Instead of saying 10 units, we say plus 10 dB. However, we also found at the same time that if you lose, you know, minus 3 dB, you will reduce the power to 1/2. If you reduce it by minus 10 dB, you reduce the power to 1/10. And so, here we are. Now we got this simple standard to work with. And it says, okay, where do we go next? Let me let it drop in case anybody's got any questions so far. Okay, so, next thing. What happens next? I said, okay, you talked about loss now, you know. What about gain? Okay, so he says, well, let's go the other way. We said if we have 79.4% get through, we could say, okay, that is, we'll say that is 1 dB. If 79.4% loss, that would say minus 1. So, very simple. Well, how do we divide this 1 up and go further? What does 1 mean that we get 1 dB gain if we lose it? We know 79.4% is a losing 1 dB. How do we get this 1 dB plus? We can't use that 79.4%. And he says, oh yes, we can in a way. So what they did, they reduced the input. And they said, we'll make the input 79.4% and then measure the output. So they measured the output, and when they measured the output, they had 126% of the signal coming. They said, gee, this is what, being amplified? And they said, well, okay, let's see how we figure this out. They took the 79.4 and they divided it into 1, and it comes out to 126%. So there you are. We now have 126% or 1. Well, I guess they called. I think they worked it down now. It actually was 126, but some say 125, and we call that as 1 dB. Anybody have any questions?
And by the way, that if you take 0.794 and divide it into 1. You get 1.2589 if you want to be a little bit more exact. So 1 dB of increase is a 25.89% increase, or 125.89% is another way of looking at it. So also, one other thing is the word deci, or decibel, 1/10 of a bell, has a lot of other origins. It's one of the prefixes you're allowed to use in science. Deci means 1/10, centi means 1/100, milli means 1,000, and so on. So these are very standard units. And so deci has been around. I'm not sure that that was invented because of the bell, but it certainly was very convenient to be used at that time. How about you, Mel? H-Y-W. WB2HWW.
Be right with you, Howie.
Well,
I
first of all, like you said, yeah, deci, no, I don't think it was the first time you ever used with bell. Was the originator of the deci. Of course, it was used, like you say, in science for a while, but they just adopted it. The mathematician that worked there adopted it. Very clever what this guy went ahead and did, and I don't even know who he is. I read about all this, but I never really saw the name mentioned of who did this
tweaking, I came up with this the actual chart. But all right, continuing on, so here we have 100, actually it came out to 1.26, the percentage, 126. And I think they, you know, take the approach that certain if I fix it, it works out to 1.94. So that made it 1.26. So you can set 126. That's the original test that was done on it. So now, okay, using that, you know, as a criteria, it's the same bone. 8.4%. That was the original, factor that we said when 80% gets through, twerks to 79.4. We could say it represents 1 dB loss, or minus 1 dB, whereas 126% would represent 1 dB gain, plus 1 dB. So there you are. I'll take this a little further. It's not too hard to understand. Now, here we have now either plus 1 or minus 1 dB, and I'll show you how that would apply in a minute. How the question?
Mel, your twitch on your microphone is giving you quite a bit of trouble. It was dropping out every half second during that the whole last transmission.
Okay, I'm sorry. Okay, how's it now? I'm holding it on an angle. I was sitting down using this thing. Is it okay now?
Sounding good now. You're going to have to get a great big C clamp for that microphone, Mel.
I got to get a stronger finger. Okay. I think somebody, Howie, was it due to have a question on this? Over. No. Okay, I thought somebody had a question. All right, so now we got this 126%. And where do we go with this 126? Well, he says, listen, look at this. Now we got this 126%. And that represents 1.25, or call that 1 dB. Okay? Now, if we take 1.26 and multiply it cubic, just as we did before, we're going to take 1.26 and multiply it by itself three times, it comes out to 2. Gee, how do you like that? If we multiply it by 10, it comes out to 10. So here we are. So now we have this situation with it, the relationship. In other words, this whole relationship goes back to the 79.4, that 80% that was torped to 79.4%. And you see how it carries over. And you say, well, what is all this jazz? I stick with things. And how to work with it? What are you going to do with this now? It sounds reasonable, I'm sure. Okay, let's say, let me give you a for instance, stick with things, how it's easy to work with DB. Let's say we have a piece of electronic equipment, and this piece of electronic equipment, we're testing it out, we're not going to use DB, we're going to use percentage, we're going to see how it works percentage-wise. So we put a signal into it, and let's say this has four stages, and we see the first stage is 79.4% efficient. The second stage is only 63.4% efficient. The third stage is 126% efficient. And the fourth stage again is 79.4%. I picked out these things because I'm sure what these mean. If it was 79.4%, we know that is minus 1 dB. It was 63.04%, it's minus 2 dB. So now, we can add these two together, minus 1 dB, and minus 2 dB, we got minus 3 dB. But then I said the third stage is 126% effective, that's plus 1 dB. So now we're back to minus 2 dB, plus 1, minus 2, plus 1 and minus 3, so we're back to minus 2 dB. And if we take the last line, 79.4, that's again minus 1 dB. So if we add them together, we've got minus 3 dB. You can see that that's a lot easier than taking all these averages and doing all the mathematics to come out with the fact that the end result is 0.500 something, and all this math, when I easily see, well, minus 3 dB, I know it's 50%. I think it's much easier to work that way with dBs, that you can add them and subtract them very easy. All right, now go on to the next thing and say, what does this jazz all mean? Well, I'm going to give you some real good examples. Somebody want to ask a question? Go ahead.
I just want to make a comment, WD2HW, that we had to change batteries.
Go ahead, Howie.
That in science, you use dB for logarithmic.